This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we just watched Season 2, Episode 5, titled The Ghost of Harrenhal. What'd you think of this episode?
I liked it.
That sounds absolutely positive.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's nothing bad about it, but there's also not a lot of, like, oh my god. Like, there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of points that I liked. It gives me a pleasure to see the Pyromancer, played by Roy Dotrice, who I've listened.
Is that old Roy?
That's old Roy.
Okay. He's,
if you don't know, he is the voice narrator for all of the books, the audio versions of the books, and he's doing one of his little accents for the Pyromancer, and it's cute. Huh. Mm-hmm. Also, this man is 94 years old, and another tragedy of Martin not getting the books out is he probably is not going to get to read them all.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a spry, like, 86 in this scene, and you can kind of tell.
Huh.
And there's a lot of other cool things in it, but, you know, this is their classic connecting episode. It's moving the plot. I mean, the interactions with Tywin and Arya were delights. Mm-hmm. Jaqen is a badass, but it's to connect the arcs plots from one to the next. It's not spectacular.
No, we're mid season here.
You can see the set pieces building up though. What'd you think?
In a lot of ways, this is like an inverse of the typical Game of Thrones episode for me, because usually they'll start off, you know, kind of building on a theme and moving stuff forward, and then by the end of the episode, they've got this big cool moment to kind of send you out with. Here it's sort of the other way around. They start with this moment where Renly is killed, which is a huge development. I mean, one king down, however many to go, 400, I don't know. and then they kind of end the episode, not with a whimper, but with a less, I guess, surprising and interesting scene in Arya and Jaqen.
But on the other hand, like, I feel like... I mean, even it's hard for me because this season is the season where I started reading the books. So I had read the entire second book before I saw the second season. But in hindsight, I do believe my original co-host, who was a non-book reader, saw the whole Renly thing coming. Like, why would you row to this place where Renly is camped and birth this shadowy monster? I mean, is it going to take on his whole army? Is it going to do stock market manipulation? Is it going to weave a complex round of demolition and all the connecting bridges of the realm so he can't get the... No.
I mean, when you think about assassins, right, they typically work in the shadows. This is literally a shadow coming to assassinate the king. So, yeah, it's not that veiled.
He's the one guy that can out Bane Bane. Oh, you were born in the darkness? I am the dark... Yeah, he could... I am the shadows in the dark. So it's like, yeah, you're right. It did open with that kind of, and it was. I still think that the shadow monster realization is very cool.
It is, yeah,
because it's tough, but they really do model it on Stephen Delane, the guy who plays Stannis. But you almost have to frame it, and it's just just a few frames where it as he's stabbing Renly, as his face kind of it takes a shape, and the eyes, I think, is what gives it away, where you can see it's like, oh yeah, that's Stannis' son. But it looks super cool when it comes creeping in on the wind, and very Angel of Death.
Yeah, there's not a lot you can do about the shadow assassin.
Yeah, and there's not much you can do about the Jaqen assassin.
Yeah, apparently.
Because he will twist your lid and throw you off a parapet and mm-hmm. be several windows away eating an apple by the time anyone's the wiser.
Yeah.
So, like I said, it's a good episode, but it's not, you know, it's not the wham, bam, slam, jam, crazy ice and fire action that, that some of them are.
Sure.
Hey, before we get to the episode, I want to talk about stuff going on here at Bald Move. Last week, we saw Blade Runner 2049. I thought that podcast was really awesome. The spoiler-free edition is there for everyone to enjoy, but if you want to hear the spoiler-filled one, you got to be a club member. This week, we're doing the same treatment to Jackie Chan coming out.
The same treatment? That might be a little ambitious. I don't know what existential, like... human versus robot questions that foreigner's going to ask. But
All I know is Jackie Chan's ancient ass is coming out of retirement to kick Pierce Brosnan's.
Are you saying he might be, in fact, an android?
You know, it's the only thing that makes sense.
A replicant?
If he can scissor kick that high and he's 79 years old, uh-huh. that's the only explanation. But it's the Foreigner, and we're going to see it this Thursday. The podcast will be out that night. Mr. Robot comes robing back mm-hmm. Wednesday night. We will have our full podcast coverage out that Friday. And every subsequent Friday, we're doing full coverage of Mr. Robot.
We are. Boom.
Also, Stranger Things. We have been behind the scenes feverishly recording podcasts for all of season one. Those are going to drop this coming Monday. Then we'll have the preview podcast and for season two out the following Friday. The next Friday is the actual return of Stranger Things. That is October 27th, I believe. And we will be marathoning those. And our goal is to have coverage for all X episodes. I think it's 8, 10?
I think it's 10 this time, yeah.
All 10 episodes.
9? Nine sounds right.
Bracket the number with fire. We'll have all of those out that weekend. We're going to marathon them and redo the podcast until we have them finished. So that's pretty fucking ambitious. I don't know why we agreed to this, but we did. So that's what's going on at baldmove.com this week.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Are we ready to get into the recap?
Please.
Okay, we start off with Catelyn telling Renly that Rob doesn't want the Iron Throne and trying to impress upon him that they're on the same side. Renly agrees that the Starks can have the North if Rob swears fealty to him once they win the throne. Or I guess now, and then they can go on to win the throne. Catelyn pleads with him to work out a deal with Stannis, but he really doesn't want to. And then Melisandre's shadow baby shows up and kills Renly and starts the episode off with a bang. And they kind of know that everyone's going to blame them for Renly's death, so Catelyn and Brienne sneak off.
Yeah,
like I said, I mean, this is a big development for the beginning of an episode.
Yeah, it changes the balance of the board quite a bit and, you know, has impacts for throughout the realm. And also it's like something where I was saying that, like, it's pretty easy to respect Rob's wishes for autonomy because nobody really wants any from the North anyway. You know, the North is not a rich... It's half of Westeros, but it's a very poor half. It's the climate sucks, the soil's poor, there's not a lot of exports and riches to be gained there. Mm-hmm. They're hard men and women that live hard lives, and it would be very easy. Because essentially, Rob has done one of those things where he's what he's agreed to here is he's essentially got a better title with no raise. Like, King of the North, what's the difference between being the Lord Paramount of the North, especially if you swear fealty to the king in Westeros?
Uh-huh.
Like, essentially nothing has changed. If I call you, you have to come to my aid. Mm-hmm. And also, there's no I mean, I guess the thing is that, you know, Rob can legitimize bastards now if he's king of, king of the North. That's not nothing.
John might have a chance. Like, right. Hey, bro, I could really use a legitimization here.
Right. There might not be like some, like, I don't know what kind of taxation or tribute that they send, but maybe that would be a little less. It's, I don't know. But yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, even Renly says that, look, nothing has really changed, right? Like, Robert and Ned had this relationship. Mm-hmm. Well, let's just continue it.
Yeah.
So I think he's got a point. The most surprising thing I think about this scene is how sort of just mundane, regular Game of Thrones scene it feels until the shadow shows up. It's like very matter of fact, like we're having a political conversation here and deciding some things, but then boom, there's a shadow assassin and it kills Renly, and then just shit goes crazy.
Yeah,
you know, the guards rush in, Brienne's got to kill him. Like,
it's kind of funny. I do think it's interesting that, you know, because we see outside before we go into Renly's tent, there's like the hustle and bustle of Renly's camp and everybody's scurrying around. And Renly gets killed. Brienne and Kat both scream. Two guys come in there. There's a sword fight. And that's it. That's it. There wasn't like a whole train of dudes like, the fuck is going on in the king's tent, you know?
Yeah.
Oh,
they've learned not to question, not to go in the king's tent.
That's right. There's some there's some screams and gurgling and just it's
what
it's,
the king does in his tent is his business. it's and even I guess if you predicted it and like saw, okay, the shadow assassin, the shadow baby is gonna assassinate Renly, it was surprising the way that it happened, I think.
Yeah.
Because it sort of happened in broad daylight, you know? It's like the next day and this baby comes in. Or at least I get the impression it was the next day.
No, when they opened that tent, It's
still night?
Yeah. It's like pitch black outside.
Okay, I think I got that impression because of the scene where Stannis is sailing in. So, yeah, I guess that takes place a while longer.
It's the Hour of the Shadow.
The Hour of the Shadow, the wolf?
The wolf shadow.
Yeah.
But I like the Brienne's reaction and how she plays this being sick with grief and she doesn't want to leave him. And, you know, Kat, you know, appealing to her reason that, like, you can't avenge him if you're dead. And guess what? You know, per what Aeron was just saying, there's going to be a literal parade of dudes into this tent all wanting because it looks bad.
Sure, it looks terrible.
I actually think that it's kind of weird that so many of the major players doubt the official story right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like everybody from Margaery to Tyrion doubt the official story of, oh, well, Catelyn and Brienne conspired to murder the king for some purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it seems like that's the most likely explanation. But, you know, I don't know what
that... Yeah, it does. I mean, nobody else knows that Robb doesn't want the throne, right?
Right.
So they would assume even, Catelyn comes in and
even
assassinates
they
this
did,
guy. And,
like, that's whatever... Like, that's sure. that's yeah. a very common populist, nationalist thing. Like, oh, I don't uh-huh. know. This is... No, please, no. I guess, you know.
Right. It's all the way down to City Hall by
yeah,
Tenacious
the false,
D.
Yeah, the false... The, the false humility is always a good play for those types.
Yeah, and this sentiment of you can't avenge him if you're dead carries on in the next scene where Littlefinger's offering to spirit away Margaery and Loras. Loras wants to kill Stannis, so Littlefinger offers to get him out of the city so that he'll have time for that vengeance. And he says the same thing to Loras. Look, or actually Margaery does. You can't avenge him from the grave. So a lot of people kind of, I guess.
Becomes a ghost.
If he becomes a ghost?
You can't say that. You can't say that anymore. When like shadows are coming out of women's vaginas and
people are
getting thrown off roofs with their neck twisted around, like, you know, maybe you can. You just got to. This qualifies as unfinished business. Every person that dies with unfinished business becomes a ghost. QED. Uh-huh. He could avenge him from the grave.
The ghost of Harrenhal, maybe.
Yeah.
He needs to make his way to
I just think it would be maybe the point is these people are a little too educated and elite to believe what the rabble believe. But I feel like in a medieval society, maybe like I would like to see somebody when they're given this speech in the show be like, fuck you. Supernatural shit exists. I'm going to come back as a revenant.
Uh-huh.
Say right there in the name. I'm coming back for vengeance, baby.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me with these two scenes is to see sort of how the cockroaches scurry when a king dies. Like,
yeah.
The king dies, and all the people who were loyal to him are now completely powerless, essentially.
Right.
And there's someone coming for them.
Yes, and you hope that you can make the whole, like, hey, you guys got the same last name? I'm a Baratheon guy. I mean,
right.
I didn't look too close to the banners. It's yeah. Especially, I guess, you'd be shitting your pants if Stannis is coming for you. Because he's a known hard ass.
Yeah.
And he's made his feelings about the matter quite known.
And he's all about justice, and I feel like his justice is harsh and swift.
Also, Miss Dormer here, when she fires that look at the camera saying, I don't want to be a queen, I want to be the queen, I fucking believe her.
Mm-hmm.
That is an ambitious woman.
Yeah, so does Littlefinger. He's got the smile on his face.
Yeah, what can I dip my little fingers in? What kind of fucking bullshit pie can I make here?
So then we go to King's Landing, where news of Renly's death has reached Cersei and Tyrion. No one knows who killed him, but Tyrion knows that Stannis now has the military superiority, both on land and sea, and he's coming for them. Cersei says that Joffrey is personally overseeing the defense of King's Landing, and she won't tell him anything about Joffrey's plans.
My hero.
Right. So Tyrion goes to Lancel, and he finds out that wildfire has been stored up and that they're planning to use it.
Yeah. Was the opening scene where Cersei is looking out over the courtyard, is that Marcella and Sansa playing some kind of Westerosi Marco Polo? I think
I was making notes at that time.
I think it was Sansa, which kind of surprised me, because I was like, I paused and it definitely looks like a dress Sansa's worn in her hairstyle, but she didn't turn around, so I couldn't confirm. And and they were laughing and playing. On the one hand, it's like, are they trying to suggest that, you know, Sansa's still a little girl here? Or are they trying to, you know, like, I thought it was an interesting character moment that they didn't really dwell on or call much attention to.
Yeah.
Like, I was expecting, like, you know, the camera to pull in on Sansa and, like, she looks behind her and kind of narrows her eye, you know, like, just that she isn't, like...
I'm having fun, but I still hate you, Cersei.
Yeah, because I feel like there's a certain type of viewer to see that and be like, oh, fucking Sansa.
Yeah.
She's just such a fart in the wind. She doesn't really mean or feel anything, but... Anyway, you didn't see it. We should move on.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, fucking Cersei is so insufferable with her. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's the royal prerogative for us to keep. You know, I've heard this recently. I've heard this like, oh, I don't want to share my war plans because the you know, then the enemies will find out.
Right.
Very convenient.
Yeah.
Very convenient logic.
Certainly, I don't know. There's obviously a lot of tension between Cersei and Tyrion, and with good reason. it's, I don't know who to put. Obviously, I'm not going to put my trust here in Joffrey. I think Joffrey is a bag of shit, and he couldn't defend a city if he had to.
Mm-mm.
I don't really know that much, I guess, about Cersei. She doesn't seem to have any military like prowess or defense capabilities. I'm just wondering about like other people, because she's clearly been talking to Varys, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are they giving her advice? Is there some good advisor behind the scenes who's helping out here? I mean, it could be Tyrion. Like, Tyrion could be that guy if he was let into the circle here, let into the loop.
Yeah, you gotta wonder, like, where did she get this wildfire idea?
Yeah.
Was there, like, this pyromancer was down in the, like, and he's like, oh, this is my time to shine. You know, I'll go up there and offer the queen wildfire. And
yeah, I don't know.
Because Joffrey didn't come up with
no.
it. Joffrey hasn't cracked a book. He wouldn't know anything about wildfire. I don't know why I don't know why Varys would suggest it, because everything I've seen to this point suggests that he would be loyal to the realm, and he's as smart as anybody. He would be able to point the flaws of this plan as well as Bronn would.
Yeah.
But she's just being, she thinks she's got this awesome idea, and she doesn't want to share credit with it. And, of course, as we find out later, it'd be a disastrous plan. So,
right.
And that's the thing. This is like what I've been saying all season of Tyrion poisoning the well and being like, here's a point where he really needs to be straight with his sister, and they need to talk this stuff out. And she is serving him a heaping helping of his smug bullshit back. Now,
sure,
she might do that anyway,
uh-huh,
but you know, anytime you take a near certainty to an absolute, you played the game wrong, dude.
Yeah,
you've played the game wrong.
Yeah, you might be right about that. Tyrion definitely has some lessons to learn as well.
But he's also, I mean, the other thing is like, so against my point is all this is for show, because he's got the pipeline to the truth. One Lancel Lannister that he's got by the balls.
Yeah.
Even torturing you is boring. Get out of my litter. That's so good.
I was wondering if this wasn't like one of those canary traps set from the opposite side here. Like, oh, I'll tell Lancel it's wildfire. I'll tell Shay that it's, I don't know, big bows and arrows.
I mean, you're right. That's like, I honestly could have, it would have been interesting if Cersei had tried that,
right?
Because she just saw it demonstrated, its efficacy demonstrated.
Yeah,
so it'd be funny if she clumsily tried to do it to Tyrion and he, but you know,
they don't
go that deep with it.
No,
you gotta wonder, like, why would the royal pyromancer switch his allegiance from the queen regent to Tyrion, like, without some kind of like threat or like, some of the stuff? It's like, when I was watching it in retrospect, it's like, it seems too easy for Tyrion. He just announces, well, you're working for me now. Okay.
It feels to me like he's saying, basically, I'm going to get control of this. Like, you think you're doing it for the queen, but you're doing it for me now.
Okay. But like, that's not
in
what he
the
actually
future,
said
I,
to the pyromancer. And the is Cersei never going to come to this pyromancer and be like, hey, how many pots you got for me?
Right.
And is the pyromancer just going to be like, oh, not mention your brother came down here? And if he does, you know what I'm saying? Like, There's another couple layers to this intrigue that I'm hungry for.
Yeah, I don't think they've revealed them yet, which that's fine. But they're certainly setting them up. And there's, I guess, a sort of funny scene with Tyrion and Lancel where he's just torturing Lancel.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good. And then he has Lancel tell Bronn to kill him if anything happens to Tyrion. Then we go over to Davos, who wants to speak to Stannis about the Shadow Baby, but Stannis has no interest in hearing it. He plans to sail into Blackwater Bay, destroy the Lannister fleet, and take the city. Davos is concerned with Melisandre's presence driving Stannis' bannermen off, and Stannis decides that he's right, and they'll leave without Melisandre. And also, by the way, Davos, you're going to command the fleet into Blackwater Bay, something that is completely foreign to Davos.
Yeah.
He's usually avoiding the boats.
Going away from the fleets.
Yeah.
And as Davos says, it's not going to be politically popular. This smuggler turned knight is going to lead them, but
it cuts both ways. Yeah, the hard truth.
It does. What do we learn about Stannis here that he doesn't want to hear about this unconventional battle tactic or Davos' review of it from Davos? Does he is because he already knows, right? Like,
I
none
think
of this
so.
Is a surprise. Yeah. Or is he afraid that if he does know that his you know, the way Stannis is would prevent him from doing... I'm not quite sure, because the way they play it is like Stannis is almost afraid to be told in black and white terms what actually happened here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like to a point Stannis can endure the hard truths.
Yeah.
But I think if you get too close to something that is bugging Stannis about himself, mm-hmm. he is probably pushing back on that.
Right.
Like, this is something that I deeply feel is probably a mistake, but it was really the only option available to me.
Right.
And so I took it.
Right.
He doesn't want to be confronted with that right now.
Right.
But he is willing. That's the thing about Stannis. He is stubborn, but he also is, in certain respects, willing to listen to the hard truths, right?
Yeah.
And integrate those ideas into what he's doing.
He's not going to go and re-argue the past, but he's willing to take into account that for the future. Like, okay, well, maybe we leave the Red Lady behind so that I can actually achieve a military victory rather than this. And also, like, I wonder what the official story on Stannis' side is that Kat probably bribed Brienne of Tarth to kill Renly for some kind of profit for her son.
Sure. One of many, I'm certain.
Because you think of this would be like just this scandalous speculation about, like, my God, on the eve of our battle, the other guy's king just fucking croaks. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Or I wonder if there'd be rumors about maybe Stannis paid Catelyn Stark to do this, because it sure is, you know, beneficial for our liege lord. But
no, it's kind of a stroke of luck that Catelyn was there in the camp when Stannis decided to send in the
Shadow
Assassin.
You're right. It kind of suits his purpose.
It gives him a cover.
It gives a lot more, like, plausible cover stories.
Yeah. So Tyrion walks through the city with Bronn, and he's trying to figure out how to defend King's Landing, just kind of observing the people. And he sees peasants sowing dissent over Joffrey's parentage, and he's pleased with that until he realizes, oh, they're also calling him a demon monkey, which he is not too happy about.
Yeah, like, as far as the city's concerned, he's the one that has engineered all this. He's the center of the corruption and the evil appetites that's going on.
When in fact, he's got to be the only person in King's Landing, aside from Varys at this point, who I would believe has any chance of fending off Stannis.
Yeah.
I mean, now that they don't have the superiority of numbers, they've got a big problem, and the only person I see solving that is either Tyrion or Varys.
Right. And we also learned that Tywin hasn't been in contact for weeks because he's probably... I mean, why not? I mean, it makes Tywin in retrospect seem a lot weaker, because it's almost like, in the way that Stannis didn't want to be told from Davos, like, Tywin's not going to invite a response from his son, who is ruling King's Landing in his stead. Like, you know, he doesn't want to hear Tyrion's bullshit about, oh, having trouble with Robb Stark, are we?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, Tywin's very proud as well, and... Yeah, to report back right now is to admit that they're losing.
Yeah.
He wants to come back with some news of victory.
Yeah. Which is, you know, it's a weakness. Anytime you can't deal with the reality in front of you, it's a weaker position than when you can.
Yeah, I wouldn't, like, put too much weight on that, because I think, you know, in those scenes where we see Tywin talking about the battle, he clearly acknowledges that he's losing.
Oh, yeah.
He's getting his ass
kicked. I don't
think
he's delusional.
He's just not willing to go back, I guess, to report on the status until he has something good to add to it.
Right.
So Theon tries to take possession of his ship, but his men they don't respect him at all. And Yara comes up and she rubs it in as his men board the ship without him. Someone there decides to take Theon under his wing and helps him come up with an attack plan that could potentially leave Winterfell vulnerable. That's kind of the takeaway that I got from this, is this last kind of sentence from Theon, where they both look knowingly at each other. To me, they're realizing that, like, if we attack this place, Winterfell will send their troops.
And as a feint,
And then we could use that to, I guess, sack Winterfell, or I don't know what other purpose like pulling their troops away from Winterfell would have.
Right. Well, first of all, like Torrhen Square is a much bigger prize than just harassing poor fishermen mm-hmm. on a stony shore.
Yeah.
And then if the Starks take the bait and send their entire garrison of Winterfell to yeah. quell that uprising, then
which it sounds like they might have at the end of this episode.
Yeah.
By the end.
Yeah, so now we shall see what happens.
Yeah, the interesting thing is going to be to see if his men will even follow him into that battle. Like,
right.
Clearly they followed him to Torrhen Square because right. we hear reports of it being taken. Right. But how far are they willing to follow
Well,
Theon?
And I think Dagmar is saying that, like, that's what you need to learn. You need to, until you command, like, Yara levels of respect.
Yeah.
You need to play into their nature. Like, Ironborn mm-hmm. don't, like, these guys don't want to go and fuck around with fishermen villages. Like, tell them that they've got some real riches and some highborn ladies to go after and some glory to seek. And they'll want, like, if they don't give a shit about following you, they yeah. want to do something that enriches and makes them grandiose. So he's trying to tell him how to rule the Ironborn way.
Yeah. And adding on from the scene with Theon and his father, Baelon, last episode or the episode before that,
right?
It really paints a clearer picture of who the Ironborn are. You know, this idea that they don't do as they're told, they do as they like, is kind of key to understanding the Ironborn. They are pirates. They are the people who go out and rape and pillage right. for the fun of it.
And this is why they've always been like a small poor people, because that right. that is great for individual glory. But you know, the yeah. whole story of humanity is the triumph of people working together to achieve larger goals.
Right.
Like an individual can become a warlord and hold a territory. A civilization can colonize the moon.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Which in the end is the path that leads to more glory and prosperity. You know, vote Aaron for a moon base. That's all I'm saying.
Wow, you're going to start as moon emperor?
Yeah, yeah,
that's
yeah.
your first public
no,
office?
No. It's a benevolent dictator for life.
Okay.
Which
I'd
I think
start
we
as
all
like county treasurer
is,
or something.
We can all agree is the best form of government, benevolent dictator.
Right. okay, we go over to Tywin getting a status report, and it doesn't look good. Rob is kicking his ass. His men aren't coming up with any good ideas for defeating Rob, and they're also complaining. So Tywin sends one of them home, who is,
he's
I guess,
seepy.
A cousin.
He's seepy. They've been
sleepy, misses a wife.
They've been planning all night long, and they right. haven't come up with anything. Oh, my God.
Yeah, the line... He says something like sleep would do us good, and he says, oh yes, and because you're my cousin I might even let you wake from that sleep.
Right.
Which is so great,
but it also shows that, like, you know, to this point they've built up the Lannisters to be the fucking empire from Star Wars.
Sure.
And now you're starting to see, like, yeah, Tywin's impressive, Tyrion's impressive, but there's some real chuckle fucks.
Oh yeah,
in the Lannister family, mm-hmm. there's some people.
There's some Piets and some.
Yes, you're right. You're right. There is
Ozzles.
There is some fruit. There's some fruit that people have chucked very far from the tree.
Yeah, for sure.
And Tywin's got his share of them. So, I think this is good world building because. Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess we've already known that because Rob has run circles around them, and we're starting to see a little bit why. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not only are Rob's men passionate about him, but like Tywin's trying to make the point that until we can deal him a military defeat, it's like this weird force multiplier that is until it's not. Like, it's like this aura around, like, he's got the NBA Jam fire halo on his head.
Uh-huh.
And until, you know, Tywin can dunk over him, he's going to continue. He's going to continue.
For sure. Do you find it compelling that we're not seeing any of these battles? We just know that they're happening and that Tywin is losing?
I mean, I think so, because, you know, it sometimes, like, reading battle scenes, unless you have a singular perspective to focus on, can be kind of tedious.
Yeah.
So I don't like, I mean, yeah, I love thrilling spectacle as much as the next guy, but like, I'm fine with the show carrying on tradition of the book from the books of largely yada yadding through the battles and just dealing with the aftermath. Because that's yeah. that's the really That's really interesting from a psychological and political perspective, and I think that's Game of Thrones' strengths.
For sure. We are getting closer to seeing a battle. We saw the beginning and the aftermath of the of the last one. Maybe eventually they'll get to a real battle that we see.
Right.
For the, I guess, the people who like to see that stuff.
Yeah,
but I'm mostly with you. I think it's interesting to see behind the scenes on both sides.
And this concept of Arya serving a steward for Tywin's War Council is such a great concept, and one that I, you know, for all of the Double D haters, this is completely invented for the show.
Mm-hmm.
This does not happen in the books, and it's just a delight.
It is.
Like Arya trying to pass off herself as being something she's not, and Tywin kind of seeing through that.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, when he asks her about Robb Stark and she tells him all this stuff, and he asks, do you believe that he can't be killed? And she goes, no, anyone can be killed. And the look she gives him, and then they pan over to the Charles dance, and he's such a fucking malignant... he's between a lich and like a Sith Lord with that fucking his pale eyes. He's that dead mackerel stare that they're always talking about Mike from Breaking Bad having.
Right,
he's got it in spades.
Yeah, he's great.
We ought to make a supercut of Charles Dance staring Jonathan Banks, like just have him and see who's got the worst dead mackerel stare.
Yeah. Maybe he's got that stare because he's not drinking.
That's true. It's clear. Yeah, Tywin clear eyed is a very scary thing.
Is that a long standing thing with him? Does he not drink just during battle? Does he not drink ever?
I think it's I think it's just more like they've been up all night. Nobody needs
depressants.
Nobody needs that right now. In fact, if Westeros had discovered coffee, they'd probably be drinking that.
Yeah. So Arya is sent away to fetch some water, and on the way she runs into Jaqen H'ghar, who is disguised as a Lannister soldier. He talks some cryptic shit about the Red God, and Arya comes away with three lives to give to the Red God. She just has to speak their name, I guess. So she names the Tickler, which apparently nickname works well enough because he's the guy who tortures people, and Jaqen says, that's all I need.
Mm-hmm.
Ominously? I don't know.
I like how she tries to bust his balls by, like, you know, I shouldn't have freed you because you're serving them. And he's like, well, yeah, you're the one at the wine pitcher.
Yeah.
You know, you're literally carrying their water for them.
Uh-huh.
Why is it right for you and not for me? So, and she's like, well, I didn't have any choice. He's like, yeah, we all do.
Mm-hmm.
And I
could have let them kill you.
Yeah, no, I think it's great. I think Jaqen's a great character, and the mystery and like the fact that this is kind of like a superpower that Arya's about to get. The fact that she's got these three lives and a man who
some death genie.
Right. And you're wondering, like, when I was watching this, I'm like, I wonder what she'll say, because I didn't remember the scene. I'm like, I wonder if she'll like try like Joffrey
or Tywin. Like,
but I mean, I think from Arya's perspective, I think I read her as that she thinks this guy's full of shit.
Okay, this is testing the waters.
This is kind of like, well, let's see if you can let's see how good you are at your word.
Now it's Cersei and Tywin. The war's over.
Right.
Because Joffrey's not fending anybody off.
Right. You see, send Jaqen off as a meat-seeking missile, and we'll see if how big Arya can dream.
Yeah, the second time through, actually, I've watched Game of Thrones several times now. Watching it through again, I'm very much more interested in what Jaqen has to say. Because the first time through, I was like, what is all of this God bullshit and death? And we owe him lives or we owe him deaths. I don't know how any of this works. This time through, I'm much more like, okay, yeah, I see what they're developing here.
Yeah.
And I guess it's interesting to see the tracks they're laying for stuff that happens later with Jaqen. So Jon and Gior talk.
That's a spoiler that things happen later with Jaqen.
Jaqen is not dead
for
at the
any,
end of this
for
episode.
Anyone that's slow and he holds up the one and kind of winks and says, I'll
the implied
do stuff later. That's right. Definitely
you
hinting.
Got two more.
There's a foreshadowing that's going to happen.
Right.
Shadow Baby kills him in the very first scene of the next episode.
That'd be pretty awesome, actually. Spoiler alert, that doesn't happen.
Or maybe it does.
Oh, boy.
Which is just obfuscations, a state-of-the-art podcast cloaking technology.
So we go north, and John and Gior are talking about the Half Hand and how they'll find him. Apparently there's going to be a horn blown or something. I don't know. The Night's Watch is venturing further north. They arrive at the Fist of the First Men, which really, really excites Sam. He is all about it. Like, the books he has read about this thing.
Man, the First Men and their fisting, it's just legend. I actually say, because I didn't notice this on the first time through, but the Fist of the First Men, sure enough, looks like a fucking fist.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the mountain range looks like a, looks like a, there you go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 4 knuckles.
I couldn't see a damn thing in this scene.
What?
Not a damn thing. They're talking about some fire. I didn't see fire.
Oh, no. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, that scene, sure.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have Eyes of the Hawk.
I guess not.
Like Corrin and John do.
Yeah, so they hear a horn blow and Half Hand arrives as Sam kind of clues them into what the different horns mean, like the number of blows of the horn.
One horn, friend, two horns, foe, three horns, White Walker, which no one has heard for thousands of years.
Yeah.
Ominous.
Very, very Obi-Wan Kenobi of them.
Yeah, yeah. And the Dolorous Ed's like, well, thanks, Sam. Now that you mention it, it's sure to blow three times.
Right.
Look at this fucking Chekhov's horn blower over here. Way to go.
The names in this show, even having watched like three times through, still confuse me.
Yeah.
Because this Corrin guy is I guess not Yorin, who is dead at this point. Very, very confusing. I just always like the names Corrin and the faces Yorin. Are hard to get.
Yeah, you're right. They rename Asha to Yara because they don't want to confuse people, but then they hit you right with Yorin and Corrin.
Right. And there's like a Quorum over at the 13 over at Karth, I don't know. It's all very confusing. Anyway.
Sounds like quite the badass is Corrin Halfhand, though.
Yeah. Yeah, from the legend. I don't know. He doesn't do anything badass in this episode, really, other than scout a fire from very far away. And the more interesting stuff that happens is later on in the episode with him. So we go over to Tyrion getting an introduction to Wildfire from this crazy old... Is this guy a maester?
He's a pyromancer.
He has a lot of fucking chains. I thought he might be a maester, but
I wonder if the pyromancers are kind of jealous of the maesters.
Well, we got chains.
Like, yeah,
we got lots of chains,
right? And they got their. There's more of a chain over. Or what are they called? Suspenders.
Yeah, yeah.
It's more of a chain suspender thing, but they were called something. Not a grace, but a wisdom. They're called wisdoms.
The people?
Yeah, like that was their, like the maesters are called maesters. This guy, I think, was called wisdom something or other.
Oh, boy.
Wisdom Dotris.
Huh.
Anyway.
Okay, anyway, yeah. So
he's also, as I mentioned in the outset, this guy is actually played by Roy Dotris, who is the narrator of all of the Song of Ice and Fire novels released thus far.
Okay. He asks... Tyrion asks how much Wildfire they have, and he's shown a fairly enormous cache of it, 7,811 pots.
Yeah.
Bronn is really nervous about this Wildfire plan. He thinks it'll actually accidentally destroy King's Landing. And Tyrion decides they're going to start making Wildfire for him instead of Cersei.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow he's going to make that come true, I suppose.
Yeah. And I thought it was cool that Bronn's like, let me get this straight. All of our best soldiers are off to the north with your father. So we've got a bunch of conscripts and irregulars. They're going to be juggling these pots that the pyromancer himself is like about to shit his pants that you'll drop it here in this room.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to launch this at the other and no one's ever going to break a pot and none of this is going to get lost into the city. It sounds like a fucking terrible idea.
Bronn just doesn't want his dick burning off. That's all.
Well, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the, you know.
Yeah, I am too, but he's overly concerned.
I'm going to run on a very strong no dicks burnt campaign for my moon benevolent dictator for life campaign.
Okay.
It's something very important to half of our population. no burn of vaginas too. I'm equal opportunity dictator.
I think maybe I should
call it dick and or vagitator because I wouldn't want to show my hand, so to speak,
right,
with my title.
Crotch tater.
Yeah, crotch tater. There you go, crotch tater.
Everybody's got a crotch.
That sounds like a hygiene problem.
It does.
Good
yeah.
God, take a shit. You're growing crotch taters, man. Jesus Christ, got a whole fresh crop of crotch taters down there.
Okay, what else do we want to say about this scene?
I think we've said far too much.
I think so,
we must
too.
Withdraw.
All right, let's move on to Dany. She's training Drogon to cook his food. She's also getting a ton of new clothes, a whole wardrobe from the looks of it. And then she wears them to, or not all of them, she wears one dress to some event where she comically prevents her warriors from pillaging the city's treasures. Then she's introduced to one of the 13 who demonstrates his magical powers and invites her to the House of the Undying. Then finally Dixos comes up and apologizes for the guy's bad parlor tricks, and a woman in a mask tells Jorah to watch out for Dany.
That's a hell of a magic show. I mean, he's a one-man Siegfried and Roy.
Yeah, I was trying to determine what the jewel actually had to do with anything.
I think
it was just a distraction, because everyone else sees what she sees, right? So
yeah.
It's not like you look into this jewel and suddenly you see multiple people.
It unleashes a mass delusion.
Yeah.
Just by staring at the jewel.
So I think the jewel is like the sleight of hand distraction
yeah.
that you're supposed to be looking at so you don't see how he does his trick.
Right. It's essentially the same. It's the Coachella hologram trick. You
know, okay.
If you stand, like, the people standing at different angles, like, what the fuck? I don't get it.
Yeah.
But there's a lot to unpack in this scene. Are you done unpacking it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because I want to talk, first of all, Drogon's fucking adorable. These baby dragons, I forgot how fucking cute they are.
They got gigantic heads.
Well, I mean, they got to grow into them, right?
They're like Funko Pop versions of themselves.
And this is the mystery, because like you had this light mystery of like, why won't the dragons eat? Well, apparently the dragons will only eat food that they themselves cook.
Yeah.
Presumably their mama dragon would have cooked it for them, but until mm-hmm. they were old enough to cook it for themselves. I like the kind of rivalry they got between the handmaidens, Daria and Eri.
Yeah.
Eri is irritated, the other handmaid, because she sees, I don't know, is she afraid that Khaleesi is going to be Westerosified?
Seems like it, yeah.
Like you're going to give up your leather tunics for your fine satin and silks.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't like it. She wants to keep Khaleesi Khaleesi. And also, Dany, low-key orders Daria to fuck Zaro, right? Or
orders
is she hinting that...
Fuck duck sauce?
Yeah. Yeah, because she's making eyes about him and like this, and she's like, oh, well, you know, men say more when they're happy.
Oh, that's true.
And she makes kind of googly eyes at her.
Oh, she wants Dany to fuck him.
No, Dany wants Daria to fuck him.
What?
I know, but then Dany...
Why would he do that?
Well,
that's not what he wants.
She's an attractive woman, and like she could just... he's a rich, powerful man. I mean, you think he's just being celibate for Dany? Fuck no.
I don't know. Have we ever seen him fuck?
He's got a different handmaiden, which is...
Are they all
in
his
case,
vault?
Euphemism for sex slave every night.
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. We haven't seen that, though.
I haven't seen that, but I feel like that's the mission that she was sent upon. And then Dany's cock-blocking her by kind of romancing the duck sauce on her own.
Yeah, none of that... seems to track.
I know. Well, you know, she's an inexperienced leader.
That's true. Yeah. And she is. She's very inexperienced, and they make a point about that.
Right. Yeah, the whole Dothraki, like, I get that their culture is different, but surely they don't think that, you know, teenage Drogo and old man Drogo are going to be able to carve up the statue in this dude's home. I mean, it makes the Dothraki, like, the Dothraki might be primitive and savage from a different cultural perspective, but what they should never be is fucking stupid.
Yeah.
And I feel like they're being portrayed as fucking stupid here.
Right. They've got, what, 40 of them max?
Yeah.
And they're in the walls of
like,
the city.
Like, yeah, these are weak, soft merchants, but guess what?
Right.
Their slave army is not going to allow you to just walk off with their fucking golden peacock.
No, it is pretty ridiculous. It feels more like a skit from a...
It really does.
Like Abbott and Costello routine or something.
It really does.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't particularly like that part, but I do... I don't know. I find it interesting this guy who shows up, who we've seen in the background before, with the purple lips, and he's talking about like the stuff they drink, and he gives them delusions, and I don't know where that fits into his quote unquote parlor tricks. Like, he clearly can do something,
right?
But what is that? Is it a projection?
Like, right.
Is it, Is it like a legitimate copy of himself?
Yeah,
what
I mean,
is
got
all
a
this?
Twin.
Yeah, oh, that would be funny.
He was doing the his twin's just doing the worm between everybody's legs, and it just pops up when Danny's looking at the gym.
Yeah.
I'm here, now I'm there. Like, this is essentially The Prestige, and which is spoilers for the movie Prestige, but,
right,
you know, hey, it's old. What, 11 million years old at this point?
And this woman in the mask, who is very mysterious as well,
Quaithe,
telling Jorah to watch out for Danny. I don't know what her deal is, but she seems to know some things.
Really cool jeweled mask.
Mm-hmm. Seen some good cosplays of that.
I have too, yeah. At the Con of Thrones we went to, there's a bitchin' Quaithe.
Yeah.
She looked like, I was afraid of her because she just looks like she's going to come over and, I don't know, throw some smoke down at her feet and take you into a negaverse where God knows what'll happen. But yeah, the invitation to, like, hey, when you get tired of Duck Sauce's sauce for his duck, then you can come on over to
the House of the Undying. Sounds ominous.
Party with the Warlocks. Yeah. Sounds like the most metal concert you go to.
House of the Undying welcomes you to see the Warlocks of Qarth.
So Catelyn and Brienne are talking about the shadow in the shape of a man. Brienne is convinced that it was Stannis. Catelyn says she plans to head home after they tell Rob about this, and Brienne asks if Catelyn will let her go at that point so she can kill Stannis.
Cat's like, you're not my hostage.
Yeah.
What the
right.
fuck? What the fuck? Quit trying to put yourself in the medieval hierarchies. We're in the woods here, sister.
Yeah, it seemed
Let's
like
just
there
howl
was...
at the moon and get naked, start a fire. Get some the witch up in here. Find your... No, I don't know.
I don't know. It seemed to be, like, out of order. Like... Okay, notice her courage. Notice Catelyn's courage. Pledge yourself to her.
Uh-huh.
And then say, oh, can I go do this Stannis thing? Are you
right.
going to let me go when I get back?
Right, right, right.
Because you're not... Yeah, you owe nothing to Catelyn at that point.
Yeah, it was a little weird. But on the other hand, like, there's a little goose pimply, too, when she draws out the sword and pledges her...
Yeah.
Her service to Kat, you start thinking, like,
although,
Kat's in good hands.
Seems like this is a pattern with her. Just right. running around pledging herself everywhere.
Right, right, right. She's quick to fall and liege.
She sure is.
She's fucking pledges on the first date, man. Yep. Can't stop. Every time she's like, this, nope, I'm just going to have coffee. Going to have pleasant conversation. Next thing you know, it's swords out.
Yep.
And she's kneeling and like, well, how the fuck did this happen again?
Okay, anything else in that scene? Or
No, sir.
All right, people come over to Winterfell in front of Bran, and they're asking for
things. If I was Brienne, I would be very suspicious of, like, promise me you won't hold me back. And Kat's like, I won't hold you back, period, 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 when the time comes.
Yeah, which is just a cop-out, right?
Yeah,
the time hasn't come yet, Brienne.
Yeah, like, ask John Wick how that works out. Ask The Rock from The Rundown, whatever the fuck his name, how that, you put yourself in service to some dude and let them define the time because you don't trust yourself. Like, it never goes well.
Yeah, that's why we have, like, written contracts now.
Yeah.
So that we can define the time, like,
right.
when is this time? When will it come?
Yeah.
What is it?
Right. I just feel like that, and even the way that the actor that plays Kat, I can't remember her name, Michelle something or other, Farley?
Yeah.
Whatever. The way she plays it is kind of like the wheels are turning a little bit. Yes, when the time comes.
Uh-huh.
Like, because I'm thinking, I don't think it's nefarious for Kat, because she's actually like, when is the time going to come where I'll feel like I'm not dicking you over by unleashing you on Stannis?
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, you're a strong, fit person, but, you know, Stannis has got, like, 100 like you around him at all times. So
yeah, that's the thing. I mean, even if you want to kill Stannis, I don't know if there's ever going to be a good time. Like, let's say Stannis does get on the Iron Throne.
Yeah.
Well, it's a worse time.
Right.
It's like, now is probably the best time
to
try
it. Like maybe instead of this knight business, you should go to a Shy, you know, wear some red robes, do some shadow baby training, find some dude in the tavern that likes you, and then that's the path forward. But yeah, I feel like that would be I worry that it's going to be a source of friction between Kat and Brienne. That, like, you know, Brienne's sure. always going to be one left off the chain, and Kat, not because she needs her as a servant, because she's genuinely concerned for her, is like, nah, now's not the time.
Speaking of confusing names, people come to not Brienne, not Bronn, but Bran, and they're asking for things, and he gives them what they need. Sir Roderick then busts into the Great Hall there in Winterfell and says, Torrhen Square is under siege, and they decide to send a whole bunch of men to defend the area. Bran asks Asha about the Three-Eyed Raven afterward. He's apparently been dreaming about it. And he's also dreaming about the sea crashing into Winterfell, which is, I think, the second piece of the puzzle, which to me says Winterfell should be worried about Theon.
Yeah.
Because they have now done essentially what Theon was implying would happen, is they sent a bunch of their troops to take back Torrhen Square.
Right.
Potentially leaving them vulnerable, and now he's got this ominous dream about the sea.
Right.
Which is essentially a stand-in for the Greyjoys in my mind.
Well, and also he specifically says, I see drowned men
right.
floating in the courtyard. Well, we just were introduced to the Ironborn's religion that consists of a bunch of drowned men. So, yeah, like this is all contemporaneous speculation. So
yeah, so this is, I mean, now the question is how accurate are Bran's dreams, right?
Yes.
Like, is Bran seeing visions of the future? Is Bran worried about the situation? Like, what is going on here?
Right, right.
And I don't think we know.
You know what else is under siege?
Huh.
Every fucking nut tree in the north.
Yeah. Yeah, Rickon.
Rickon has gone on a one-man war against all Nutbear. Like, he's just
going to town
over there.
Why would you let that happen next to you?
Just because, you know,
I couldn't think. I could not think with nuts being smashed loudly next to me.
I couldn't either. I couldn't take the Lord's, you know, it's like, I'm sorry, would you say, what about the orphans? what? I mean, it is very distracting. I'm surprised. Yeah. Plus, why does Bran have to do it? Shouldn't Lewin be kicking him under the table? And what the fuck is Bran? What's Rickon even doing there?
I don't know.
Like, emergency backup plan for Bran? Just so it's like, you know, it's like, well, you know, sit in on the Lord's duties just in case.
Right. In case Bran decides he's done with this.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe they're trying to save the nuts so the king, like, okay, we'll send him at the table. Surely he can't smash them. God damn it, he's smashing nuts.
Where'd he get all the nuts from?
But yeah, Sir Red, and, you know, they've also got Maester Lewin, who we think is a smart dude, and he's saying, do we need to send all these guys? And
yeah.
And Roderick saying, yeah, all their best men are down south with Rob, but I could probably scrounge up the rest of the good men.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I mean, I don't fault Bran, because what he says is true. If we can't protect our bannermen, how can we expect them to protect us? And
yeah,
obviously, you know, Roderick's like, you know, that makes him like, yep, this is a good kid I'm following. Another couple, by the time I'm dead, my son will have a decent lord to serve. So yeah, like they're in a tough spot here.
Mm-hmm. Yep, no good solutions. All right, then we go back.
Also, I'm surprised that Bran lets Asha be as evasive as she is. You know, because he's asked her like 3 or 4 times, like, seriously, stop fucking with me. What does the wildling say about
the three-eyed ravens?
At the end, she says, they say all kinds of crazy things. Well, tell me those crazy things.
Right.
I'm the Lord of Winterfell. I command it. You know,
say,
these people you're talking about, these people you're worried about putting you in chains. I'm now one of those people. I'm the pert people. I'm the people most likely to put you in chains, and everyone will listen to me. So fucking tell me right now, what are these crazy things?
Yeah.
Like, can't be crazier than his shit old Dan was spinning back when I was a kid, so come on.
That's true. Yeah, everything he knows he's gotten out of storybooks, essentially.
and surprisingly, it's all useful.
Yeah. So we go back north, and Corrin's pointing out a fire where some of, I guess, Mance's scouts are gathered, and they're waiting. They're going to go back and tell Mance if they're discovered. So Corrin suggests some guerrilla tactics to sneak in and kill Mance, which starts with taking out the scouts by the fire. And everyone seems to want to go, but eventually Jon is allowed to go with Corrin to take them out.
Yeah, I love a good old commando mission.
Yeah, I see nothing in this scene. I don't know if I'm supposed to, or if that's like the point is this guy can read the land and knows the score better than I do, better than the viewers do, but yeah, I saw nothing in there.
Yeah, well,
just a blank white.
If you saw it on IMAX, you'd see the pinprick of light that they're talking about.
Okay.
It's kind of like,
I was looking for smoke. I was looking for fire.
It's kind of like in Lawrence of Arabia, if you watch like the VHS version for the first time, there's like a no shit 5-minute scene of Peter O'Toole gazing off into the desert. And you're like, what the fuck? And then years later, you watch the Blu-ray version or you see it on a screening. And you're like, oh, I'm actually watching a man emerge from a mirage and resolve. Like you can, and that's like it's telling you what it's like to be out in the desert in the vast expanse. It's completely lost on a standard definition TV on a VHS tape.
Huh.
So yeah, I just assume that when they come out with 4K, when I get a 4K television, I pop in the 4K Blu-ray. I'm going to see that pinprick of light that they're talking about.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I thought I had a good definition copy of it. anything else in that scene? It's pretty straightforward.
Don't think so, yeah. The whole thing, there's they're building more legend around Mance, the turncoat black brother who's now the king in the north, and they're worried that they're going to teach them to fight, like, you know, because the, so far, every time the Night's Watch shows up with their good forged castle steel, they just rout the wildlings because they're undisciplined and, you know, can't hold the line, and Corrin's like, these ain't your father's wildlings.
Mm-hmm.
They got some backbone now.
Yeah. Mance is doing great things up north, I guess.
He's got the whole fucking, and he's like, how many wildlings does he have? And he's like, all of them.
Yeah. So we go back over to Karth, where Zardoz von Duxos points out that Jorah loves Dany, and he asks her what she desires. She says she wants to take the Iron Throne. And then she asks what he wants, and he takes her to a vault that he swears has a whole bunch of really cool stuff inside.
Right.
And why offers would he half in return for her hand in marriage.
I mean, why would you have that ridiculously expensive, impenetrable vault
right.
that you would pay people to break into if you didn't have vast sums of riches behind it?
You know what's cheaper than a vault full of riches and gold and gems and jewels?
A big fucking fancy door.
Uh-huh.
An impenetrable
that you tell
door.
People has gems and jewels and riches behind it.
Right, right.
In order to get them to marry you. This is crazy. This is crazy that Dany would even consider this. So, yeah, so...
I mean, she's young and experienced and kind of desperate. Because
right.
she has...
And that's the point of this.
The only thing she's got is her mystique, her dragons, and her immense physical beauty.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that she has got in this world that she's got to work with. And it's not a great starting hand.
No, I mean, she's looking for a boat.
Yeah.
Any boat.
Any
apparently.
Boat will do.
And when she finds out that Robert Baratheon is dead, I think it puts a fire under her a little bit.
Yeah.
Because now she has the opportunity to go back without being immediately hunted and killed.
And they say, like, in between this scene and where we get to Eeyore fucking Mormont, that... this guy's told her a bunch of current events, like the fact that the kingdom's in shambles and the usurper's dead, and like Westeros is, in fact, ripe for the picking.
Yeah, and a lot of people are trying to pick it. So Dany then goes to Jorah to try to convince him that it's a good deal, but he doesn't trust Duxos, and he volunteers to find her a ship that will take them to Westeros.
Yeah, and they have a moment here, an uncomfortable moment, where I think... I mean... Has Dany really been blind to the fact that Jorah loves her this time? Because
it seems like it.
It
That's
seems
the way they
like
play it.
And that, you know, as soon as she realizes... Now, I guess the more interesting question is, does she have feelings for him? Because she retreats to this, like, very proper, like, breaks eye contact, conspicuously refers to her as my advisor when she asks for his advice. But yeah, his counsel is, which I... Like I said, I agree... With what the Eeyore here is trying to push. But also, I feel like the opposite of crazy is still crazy. Bitch, you cannot go to Westeros with one ship and get all of... And get, like, you know, we're just going to find our allies over there. Why?
Because
of Targaryen name?
Yeah.
Come on.
No, I mean, the
Wait,
other name.
That's going to work on Stannis? No.
No, not on Stannis, not on Rob.
Right. Like
they don't care.
I felt like she... The unfortunate truth is Dany, like, she needs to listen to the what part of what Eeyore is saying here with make your own way, which would be eschewing both Duxos and Eeyore's way. But this whole, you don't need one ship because you go across there with your three baby Funko pop figure dragons is going to carry the day is stupid. And I feel like that Jorah probably knows it's stupid, but he is...
emotionally and intellectually compromised by his love for Dany.
Yeah, that's
and
the jealousy. Thing. It's hard to tell where the line is. Like, does he truly believe this is a bad idea, or does he love Dany and not want her to get married off to this guy?
Because I feel like a visor with real loyalty would say something like, it's a compelling offer this guy's making. You just need to make sure that he can deliver the things he can deliver before you get in. But also, maybe consider these other things. Mm-hmm. Like, because it also seems equally foolish to just reject Duck Sauce's offer just on the face of it.
Yeah,
because if it's legit, I mean, that's a pretty good deal. A sham marriage and sharing the power with this to get everything you want. And like,
yeah,
you know, well, that's a pretty damn good offer.
Ah, but will she be happy?
You know, as a Game of Thrones fan, I'll take it. I will trade Dany's happiness for her whipping ass in Westeros.
Huh.
The tail end of season two. I take it right now.
Well, at the very least now she knows that Jorah loves her, right? Like there is obvious realization here.
Right.
That what he's saying doesn't just come from, you know, his brilliant tactical mind, it's also coming from the heart.
Which is scary. I think it's also scary.
It is.
It's not exactly reassuring.
Yeah, and I think it's scary to Dany because she doesn't really know if that's something that she's interested in or like how that complicates things. So, sure. Then we go on to Arya schooling Gendry on how to practice for a fight before they're interrupted by the Tickler's body falling from the wall and Jaqen giving her a big old thumbs up.
Yeah, he's got the shit-eating grin and an actual eating face and holding up the one finger. There's your first one.
This wasn't like a particularly big scene. It didn't feel like this was a big development. It sort of went out just like on a, oh, okay. Yeah, so he can do the thing he said.
Yeah. Although, I mean, it is pretty gruesome because, like, that dude's neck was rotated 180 degrees from where it should be pointing, and then he got thrown off a tower. Like, I wonder if we're supposed to, like what, are we supposed to be impressed with the stealth and the, like, the plausible deniability of the kill? Or, like, because I, as I'm watching the scene, I'm thinking, Ghost of Harrenhal my ass, someone's going to know that this isn't an accident because his head's twisted halfway around. But then again, like, maybe that's something that can happen when a body falls from four flights into a bunch of flagstones. I don't know. And maybe. I don't know that what we're supposed to draw, because, like, I could believe anything going in the next episode. Is Tywin going to come in like, what is the meaning of this? We have a fucking spy amongst us. Or is he going to be like, fucking Tickler, I told him, stick to water in the mornings, and fucker didn't, and he got drunk and fell off. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it's weird. If they just showed that he was like a dead, like, you know, butt, head busted open on this pavement, I'd be like, oh, it looks like an accident.
How many Lannisters get sent home for this? Like, everybody starts going, oh, Ghost of Harrenhal, Tywin, Ghost of it.
Right. Oh, this place is haunted. Yeah, a couple.
Sure,
they
it
might
is.
Be
you,
sent home.
Go home.
They might be so sent home minus their head because
yeah.
I have a distinct feeling that this like cousin getting sent home to his wife is like a one-time offer.
Yeah,
next guy pisses him off.
He's yeah, going this to is get, not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Yeah.
You can't just say, oh, yeah. I'm tired,
this is
my
putting,
wife
this
misses
This is putting
me.
The rest of you fuckers on notice
uh-huh.
that I am not here. This is not my fucking around pants.
Especially if your name isn't Lannister. Like,
oh,
if you're
yeah.
in that group and your name is not Lannister, you are on alert.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be, it would. Yeah, I would, if I'm not, if my name's not Lannister, then I'm minding my P's and Q's.
All right, that's the end of the episode.
Yeah. Should we do feedback?
Let's do it.
Hey, before we move on to feedback, I just want to remind everyone that we have a club, club.baldmove.com, which you can join for a certain amount of money. Three lives.
Yeah.
You have to save three people's lives, and then you get three bonus episodes of podcasts, and you got to go back to saving lives. I hate to tell you. I didn't make up the rules. It's a red god. Or you can use your credit card. If you want to avoid paying the iron life-saving price,
yeah.
You can plop down your Visa or MasterCard.
I hear you can also do Amazon.
Amazon?
That's what I've heard.
What kind of witchcraft is that?
My sources, which is me, told me.
A shadowy Jeff Bezos comes and says, payment approved. And then he whooshes out your tent.
Yep.
Well, if you want to truck with that kind of black magic, it's on you. Either way, you end up at club.baldmove.com. You can sign up. You get a bunch of bonus features. So many bonus features. We have video versions of our podcasts. We've got extra audio content that we release every month, extra video content, video game playthroughs, ad-free feeds, VIP access to the forums. Oh my God, first run Bald Movies, where we get all spoilery about stuff we just saw. It's great. Like, you know, you watch a movie that weekend. Who are you going to talk to about it? Your idiot family, your dumbass friends, your coworkers. No. You want Jim and Aaron to talk about that stuff to you, and we've got you covered, family. At club.baldmove.com.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, the very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. All right, we have a bit of non-spoiler feedback before we get into the spoiler section. We talked a lot this last week. By the way, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com if you want to send us feedback. We've been talking this week and last, making jokes about the Hour of the Wolf. And John G. wrote in and said, I recently did a full reread of the series, and Gurm never mentions anything about the Hour of the Wolf until around book 4 and 5, which he wrote concurrently. So it appears to be a late idea of his in his book universe. From what I remember, he never clearly states what times those are. It appears to be late at night near to dawnish. Near to dawn-ish.
The Dornish?
The Dornish, yes. Yes, yes. You can only say it down south. Jon Snow mentions it as being near sunrise. It's also mentioned in a list of other hours. Hours of the nightingale and owl, moonrise and sunset, dusk and dawn, which spurred Aaron to actually look this fucking thing up. And it turns out there's a whole article on it on the Wiki of Ice and Fire, because of course there is.
The known hours to exist are the hour of the bat, which is apparently sometime during deep night to early morning, hour of the eel that comes just after the hour of the bat, hour of ghosts coming just after the hour of eel. Come on, Tywin, if there's no ghosts, why would we have an hour for them? Think,
yeah.
Tywin.
Yeah.
The hour of the owl coming a few hours after the hour of the bat, still before dawn. Hour of the wolf, the blackest part of the night, coming after the hour of the night, or the hour of the owl, and the hour of the nightingale coming after the hour of the wolf. So there
are there no daytime hours that get names?
Jesus, that's next episode.
Okay.
Yeah, you got the hour of the jackass who asks about hours. That's new.
I want to get to the bottom of this. I gotta know the name for every hour of the day.
It reminds me because
we should design a Westeros watch,
right?
It doesn't have like numbers. It has pictures of animals,
and it's not even pictures. It's like those speaking spells where it just like the hour of the bat goes. What is a bat like? Flap 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 flap. You know, hour of the owl says whoo. Hour of the ghost says spooky spooky. Yeah, I think that would sell.
Mm-hmm.
It could just be like one of those skin, like they got the GoldenEye skin for the smartwatches.
Just an app for your smartwatch.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Let's do that. $1 million idea. Jennifer C, I have a question about Theon for the rewatch. If Theon came to Starks as a quote unquote ward, does that mean that when he came of age, he would have been free to go? Was Baelon expecting him to return to the Iron Islands at some point and be an heir to that throne, or was he required to stay at the Starks forever? Baelon on the show seems to have written Theon off, but I am not clear on whether that is because that's how wards work or because Baelon is a stubborn jerk or bad father. Without understanding that, I have a hard time figuring out how much of a plot twist it was that Theon betrayed the Starks or whether it's entirely foreseeable to everyone but the Starks that that would happen. That's a great question, and I had to do a lot of research because there is not... I'd read a lot of different sources and a lot of different discussion stuff on the internet because there's not like a correct answer.
Mm-hmm.
In as much that Martin based this on real Roman and medieval practices of hostage taking and ward raising, the way it would work is that Theon would essentially be a hostage of the Starks until Baelon died. And then most usually that person would be released to go rule the house. And the benefit is you've had perhaps decades to, like, the Romans would take children from the barbarian chieftains and raise them to essentially be Romans.
Yeah.
And then when their dads died, they'd send them back out. And now all of a sudden these guys are wearing togas and they've shaved their mustache.
Yeah,
and
it's a form of colonization.
It's a form of cultural colonization. So the idea of, I'm going to ensure your good conduct because I'll kill your kid if you don't comply. And then once you die off, a part of me, I've essentially planted my flag inside your house for all time to come is pretty compelling. The other kind of cool insight is that wards in Game of Thrones are not considered – they're treated like honored guests, but they're not considered guests. So them betraying their family, betraying their family does not invoke some kind of like guest right betrayal thing because it's like, kind of expect that.
So I think my reading on this is that Baelon has totally written off Theon.
Yeah.
Because in my mind, like,
he knows how this works.
He's not a Greyjoy anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and if he is a Greyjoy, like, he's not going to be held hostage by his own son, I guess. By the Starks over his own son, because his son at that point, you talk about the Romans and how they did it, is essentially a Stark.
Yeah. No, I mean,
And once he dies, he doesn't want the Iron Islands to be ruled by a Stark.
Right. It does give a little bit more depth to, like, Baelon's he's still a petulant jerk ass.
Sure, yeah.
And he would have been, a lot smarter to... I mean, it seems like the smart play would be to back Rob, use – because the other thing that I got in my research is, I guess if you did a significant act of fealty and loyalty that you could win a hostage back, that, like, do whatever Rob wants you to do, get Theon back, and then you can act with a free hand.
Yeah.
And also you've established, now you've got a clear dominion over your own islands. Like, there's a lot of stuff you could do then, but, This research and this question by Jennifer, I agree with you. I think it gives a little bit more depth to the machinations that Baelon was considering in his head.
Yeah.
And also that he, he fully expected Eddard Stark to do this kind of, cultural destruction, because that's part and parcel of the custom. So, you know, we know.
And how could you not? Really?
And also the thing is like, I'm not so sure that Ned didn't, because as we mentioned, Ned didn't do anything as far as preparing him for what the Iron Islanders are actually like and what their culture actually is.
And you can't. I mean, living in a different location with a different culture necessarily influences you.
Right.
You know, you can't be an Iron Islander in Winterfell.
Right. And from Ned's perspective, he probably I'm saving you from being an asshole.
Right.
Like, this is the best thing that's ever happened to you, boy. You could have grown up to been a shithead Iron Islander. And I agree with Ned there, but then you start getting uncomfortable things like, that's kind of like what everyone that's ever, like, that's what happened to Aboriginal Australians. That's what happened to, you know, First Nations here in America. Like, it's always like, oh, well, we're going to save you from your fucking savagery.
Right.
So we're going to, it's not always, not everyone doing that as Ned Stark is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And certainly.
Especially
not,
when your plan is then to install them as the ruler of that area and thereby influence everyone who lives there.
Right. Jason L., this episode adds a lot of mystic elements to the show. Jack and Hagar, Quaithe, Bran's visions, and I suppose the Shadow Baby Man Assassin. Which of these intrigues you the most?
I think Jaqen. How he's able to essentially promise that he can kill the whatever three people are named.
Yeah.
That's a big ask of someone, I would think.
He's certainly cooler. Like, he's essentially like a Westerosi James Bond by this episode.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like Bran's visions might expand the world more.
Okay.
Because if you actually have this uncanny power, like, it's cool to be a crippled boy that can, you know, drone pilot his wolf around. But if you can actually predict the future, that's a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that, as you know, and that kind of power and responsibility in a very young boy's body and mind is a very intriguing concept.
So yeah,
I think I side with you and Jack, and he's definitely the cooler, more flashier, but like Bran's vision seems like it's more of a game changer. And that is the regular feedback we have. We will now be going into the spoiler section, which means you probably want to stop listening at this point if you are not caught up with the books and or the show.
Right.
So if you're caught up with the show, you probably are fine because the show is way far beyond the book. So just come. Don't be afraid. But if you're not caught up on the show, or you haven't, if you're absolute purist about book spoilers influencing your show enjoyment, then maybe give this next section a pass. Otherwise, send in feedback, GameOfThrones@baldmove.com, and we'll see you for more non-spoiler thoughts next week.
All right. That's it for this week. See everybody who's not doing spoilers next week. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.
And we're back with the spoilers.
Dragon count still stands at 0.5.
0.5? Yeah.
Because we got the My Dragons last episode.
Yeah, the previously on stuff is going to be what we're watching for. Are you watching those, the previously ons?
No, I'm not.
Are you skipping those? Oh, shit.
Are you watching them?
No. On second watch, I accidentally let one play.
Hmm.
So,
I was taking notes at the end of this episode all throughout the credits, and it just rolled to the next episode. It didn't actually show a previous one. You have to actually, I think, go to extras and watch them. I'm not sure what triggers them.
Okay. I don't know.
So I guess maybe – yeah, fuck it. I don't know. so I want to talk about a couple things. I like the introduction of Quaithe, but they don't really do anything with her. Like in
Quaithe
the books,
is the masked woman.
Quaithe is the jeweled mask-wearing woman, and in the books she delivers a bunch of warnings and kind of prophecies that we're going to be talking about here a little bit in more depth, the Dany. In the show, they don't, and I wonder if they were hedging their bets because this season was made before Dance of Dragons even had dropped. I think Dance of Dragons dropped right before this season or immediately after, maybe even during it. And it just feels like the Double D's maybe like covering their bases, like, this might be an important character, so let's at least introduce her and have her say some mystical mumbo jumbo, and then that way we can have her on the previously on when we pull her out of her ass in season 7. I feel like that there's a lot of that stuff, and when George stopped writing, they just started taking the red line through and like, okay, well, we don't need fucking Quentin, which means we can abandon this dumpster fire of a Dorne plot, and we're not going to do the young Griff, which means like, why do we even need Quaithe now? I'd get rid of her. Like there's a lot of editing ripples that go through, but it's too bad because I think she's going to be a somewhat important character in the book, because she gives Dany a lot of this mystical advice. She comes back later in when she's ruling as Marine, and Dany is like having visions of her as she's almost dying from dysentery out in the fields after she escapes the fighting pits of Drogon. So,
I honestly didn't. Like, I remembered the character, but I didn't remember anything she did from my previous watches. So.
I think she shows up one more time, and she might say something cryptic about Dany's path. Or, like, they might have a little bit of that prophecy, but certainly not of the, like, the Mummer's Dragon stuff that we're about to talk about. And the other thing is, I couldn't help but watch when Tyrion was doing all the stuff with the Pyromancer, and we talked about how there's, like, a couple steps maybe missing from the full intrigue that in the books... Tyrion's big trick is the big secret that he's working behind the scenes is he's having this giant chain manufactured.
Yeah.
And throughout the whole book, you're reading what the fuck he's going to do with his giant chain. And what it is after Stannis sails his whole fleet into Blackwater Bay, there's this enormous winch house that winches that chain to about 3 feet over the water. Mm-hmm. And then he unleashes the wildfire. And that's like, his sister's always trying to figure out what the fuck is going on. Why are you having all of our armors build the chain? And it's, I guess, fundamentally more interesting than Tyrion finds out his sister's doing something with wildfire and steals the part of her plot that makes sense, burning Stannis, and changes the delivery system.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they cut the chain.
Yeah, I mean, the chain would have been so fucking cool.
It seems like a cool idea. Maybe they were worried that the stuff they were going to do with the wall later was a little too similar. Like with that big side or whatever
they
got.
Oh, there's no way they thought about that side at the time they were writing the episode. It's always been like,
is that an addition that...
Oh, yeah, that shit never...
In the books?
No.
Maybe they were like, oh, fuck, we missed the boat on this chain thing.
Right.
Let's put it on the wall instead.
Yeah, or that's like, you know, or then it's like, well, we know... Because, again, I don't even think they thought about dredging the dragon out of the ice water either, so...
Huh.
I always thought, like, the whole season, I was like, oh, man, it's going to be such a cool visual when they crank that thing out of the water and you realize that Stannis is like, it's trapped. It's been sprung. And they just never do it.
Huh.
It's too damn bad.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I did like Lancel swearing in the Light of the Seven. I thought that was interesting considering his future path.
Yeah.
Nice little touch there. I don't know if that's intentional foreshadowing or if it's just, you know, well, this is part of his character.
It also makes sense because, you know, like I know there's a lot of people said, man, his character arc is a little extreme. But I feel like that if Lancel is sitting there pondering his life, he's a good candidate for religious conversion because all of the things he's done to pursue his vanity and his lust and has led him to these bad paths where he has to betray his family and where he's got this demonic monkey guy, you know, pulling the strings and, you know, a young guy like that with the right kind of, religious zeal that's instilled into him with a charismatic leader is exactly the kind of guy that would fall for a cult like that. Like, well, shit, maybe all these bad decisions are, instead of just like, hey, you fucked up, made a bunch of bad decisions, like, oh, no, you've angered the gods, and that's why your life hasn't turned out the way it is.
Right.
Anyway.
And we also, I think, from time to time question, like, what are Bran's powers? Can he see the future? Clearly, he can dream about events that have not yet happened.
Yes.
And that's interesting considering, like, what his power level is in level 7, season 7, compared to his relatively low power level here, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does that say something about what Bran is able to do with his newfound Raven powers?
Well, I guess the real question I'd have is, are these powers that Bran has manifest control over, or is he a receiver that gets the message that...
From the Three-Eyed Raven, but he's...
Some supernatural entity wants him to see.
Okay.
Granted, that kicks the can down a little bit, but I think it's an important distinction to know what are powers of Bran the boy slash man, and what are the powers of either the Three-Eyed Raven or the mystical power that he's getting that inspiration, like the Lord of Light or whatever flip side of the Lord of Light.
Exactly. I was going to go to
that guy, like Bran has a set of motivations and things that I can understand, whereas...
Yeah.
The old gods or whatever, they are ineffable at this point.
Right. And we have seen that they work in the more mysterious ways, you know, like the visions that Melisandre has. She doesn't ask for those visions. She doesn't go out and like say, hey, I want to see this specific thing. Yeah. She's just given what she gets.
And pointedly, she gets a lot of her interpretations wrong. And like, you know, the other thing is like, of what use is foretelling the future if you don't understand the prophecy until it's already occurred?
Sure.
Like Bran, I mean, I get it for here. It's like, you know, this is like a puzzle that you could kind of figure out. Oh, the drowned men and all that. And especially if you're a watcher of the show, you can...
Right, you have more pieces.
You can realize that. But, you know, he's like, okay, well, I got these visions and they mean something. Like, it's the Nostradamus thing, right? Like, if you say enough weird cryptic shit, anything can mean anything retrospectively.
Mm-hmm.
So the real question is, at what point will these actually... will he actually see something that is going to be of value to the Allies? That's going to have some kind of predictive, strategic value, because we haven't seen any evidence of that.
No, the stuff about Jon is not really strategic.
Yeah, because as a lot of people pointed out in season 7, like, I think Bran was seeing future events, like when he was seeing the Night's King at the lake and at that weird mountain, the arrowhead shaped mountain. He just didn't understand the significance of it, and he didn't know if it was in the past or future or what.
Right.
Like, if he had seen that and realized the significance, he could have warned Jon, but he didn't. So is season 8, are we actually going to see this power be actually useful?
Mm-hmm.
That's a big question.
All right, that's all I've got for spoilery stuff.
All right, let's get to the feedback then.
All right.
Joe M. says, I'm currently in the middle of a dance of dragons. There's a particular prophecy given by Quaithe to Daenerys. Oh, bringing it back to Quaithe. Prior to a meeting with Tyrion, the quote reads, "Hear me, Daenerys Targaryen. The glass candles are burning. Soon comes the Pale Mare, and after her the others. Kraken and Dark Flame, Lion and Griffin, the Sun's Son and the Mummer's Dragon. Trust none of them. Remember the Undying. Beware the perfumed seneschal." Given this information, I'm wondering if Tyrion is the betrayer some people suspect him to be. If not in the show itself, maybe in the books. Do you remember, like, we talked about this prophecy about 8 episodes ago?
Sure. A lot of people were speculating that it might be Varys as well.
Right, because he literally is.
Perfumes, yeah.
Essential is essentially like a steward or a minister.
Mm-hmm.
But to his point, Tyrion, when he goes across the Narrow Sea, he's taking a ship called the Celesori Corhan, which translates into Fragrant Steward.
Ha! Okay.
Interesting. So that's kind of cool. But the rest of this, like the prophecy, it's like there's a lot of cool stuff that's already come to pass. Like the glass candles are burning. That's a reference to the magical obsidian candles that the maesters make their acolytes stay in a room with to try to light and... The maesters have retconned this as to a teaching of humility, that you can't do everything.
Right.
And they've apparently missed the fact that in olden times, these candles actually were lit through some magical process. And now...
It'd be great if Sam discovered that and got him to light.
Well, he might. He might. Because that Master Marwyn, who's kind of like the warlock at the Citadel, has been studying this shit. And he wants to meet Dany at the end of book 5. Soon comes the Pale Mare. That is the dysentery that sweeps... There's so many calamities in the books to fuck on happen to the Marine. And one of them is this disease... rages through the city. Kraken and Dark Flame is referring to Victarion and his smoking right hand of doom. Lion and Griffin talking about, pretty sure the Lannisters and Griffin are the, you know, references the Griff, the guy who's the protector of the young Aegon, perhaps the fake Aegon. The Sun's Son, that's Quentin Martell. Prince Doran's son, the Martell's house sigil is the sun spear, and the Mummer's Dragon. And a lot of people think the Mummer's Dragon, meaning the fake dragon, the puppet dragon, is actual that young Griff, that the Aegon Targaryen. And beware the perfume sigil. There's a lot of people that could mean. Tyrion is definitely on the list, and whether it's a red herring or not, I don't know. As soon as I saw the translation of that trading ship, I'm like, God damn. And also... You know, if we're honest, they're sowing a little bit of seeds of discontent with Tyrion in season 7, so maybe he is one of the betrayers.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, how much is that going to influence the show?
Right.
Like, because honestly, I know it sounds like a dumb thing to say, but I don't care about the books because I haven't read the books.
No, you're
not. I'm not
going to
read the books. It's interesting to see, I guess, how they inform the show.
Yeah.
Like, could they, without going into all the detail of young Griff and Quentin and all these other characters who don't even exist in the show, could they still be getting around to the same conclusion?
Well, that's what
I think the answer is definitely yes. We've seen a lot of that happen.
And when you see John take the name of Aegon, you know, as we discussed, the Toby. A lot of people think that maybe some of the whatever drama between this mummer's dragon that's foretold to happen between him and Danny, that some of that's going to be laid on to John because they want to hit the same beats. Like that's,
and they're using the same name. It's like
that's the whole reason we still talk about the books, because everyone takes as a matter of kind of faith, and maybe we're wrong on that, as people sometimes email to point out that. You know, we think that certain prophecies that are not in the show, they're still going to be true in the books.
Yeah.
So to the extent that, you know, let's say if Tyrion kills Cersei in the show, is Jaime going to kill her in the books? Like big things like that, no one thinks are going to be different. There's no real reason that we think that.
Sure.
Because it could be that the Double D's are like, you know what? Fuck you and your bullet points, old man. We're going to take this wherever we want to go. That would be shocking.
It would be.
And when the books come out, like, very controversial and shocking, but it could be true.
Yeah.
So let's move on to Jason from Milwaukee. Correct me if I'm wrong, as it's been a long time since I've read the books, but I remember pretty clearly it was actually the Starks that took Harrenhal, and Robb leaves Roose Bolton in charge. This is who Arya actually serves rather than Tywin. I always wondered why they changed this, and it came down to one of two things in my mind. Roose does some really strange things. His leeches, his flaying. Is it possible that they didn't want to reveal that this was a very odd dude, which in turn makes the Red Wedding more of a shocker? Or two, did they just want to do more with Charles Dance? I personally think the actor who plays Roose, sorry I forget his name, was also great, but wasn't the strong screen presence that Dance was.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think it's both. Because you're right, they set up Roose to be this creepy, not very Stark guy, like more of a traditional villain, where you can certainly see that Robb doesn't agree with his methods, but there's nothing that hints that the Boltons are bad news until Ramsay shows up.
Yeah.
So, and then also I think, yeah, Charles Dance is awesome, and he has really good chemistry with Maisie, and they I don't think they knew that when like they cast and all that, but maybe they did because they had Charles Dance in season one. They knew what they had in Maisie Williams. Maybe they're like, hey, we want to see these two play together. But whatever, I think is one of the most inspired book changes because it plays so well this season.
Yeah.
Any other analysis?
Why is it? I'm questioning why it's interesting to have Arya serving Roose.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's interesting. It's just that, like, that's what the Gardner Martin came up with.
Okay. I think it's way more interesting to have her in the belly of the beast. Like,
you're right.
Far more interesting.
But there's a lot of other, because, like, for various reasons, Arya doesn't feel safe with Roose, and she still maintains this kind of, because you're right, like... Mm. You know, there's the essential problem that Arya could have told Roose that, hey, I'm Arya Stark, get me back to... And Roose probably would have complied at this stage. Because
why
wouldn't
he? He's on Rob's side.
And it'd also be a really fucking giant risk for him to just off Arya.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, a lot of Arya's story is identical. It's just the crucial substitution is they took out Roose and they put in Tywin.
Yeah, I think that's a smart change.
Yeah. I wonder, like, I bet Martin would agree with you, too.
Huh.
Then, I don't know. Maybe not. Rick says, regards to John being named Aegon, I know this is off the wall, but what if, and it's a big if, John in the books is really dead. He's not coming back, and being Kit is very popular for the viewers. The Double D's decided to bring him back to life and interject his plot with the young Griff storyline.
Oh, my God. That's a huge change.
I mean, so there's more to this email, but that's essentially the plot, the point.
Yeah.
I don't know, because there's just so much foreshadowing of John being important, if not just Azor Ahai outright, that preoccupies the first five books. Like, the books sing with this all these hints about his parenthood and his true lineage and his you know, for Christ's sake, Melisandre
keep seeing him instead. Like every time she prays for a glimpse of Azor Ahai, the fucking
Tower
flames
of Joy
keep
stuff. Like,
right,
where is that all going if John's just totally eliminated?
Right, and there's even like even in the books, Martin introduces a lot of mechanisms for John to be brought back to life. Like there's the whole. I forget the Weimer Six Skins, or maybe it's Weimer Six Skins. He's a wildling that they introduced the concept of the second life. Like when a skin changer gets old and dies, a lot of times they'll transfer their consciousness into like a bear or a wolf or whatever to continue having some form of life. And you know they show this guy like you know leaping to a he tries to leap into a person as he's dying. And he's not strong enough, and the person goes insane and rejects him and, like, tears up their face, and he's forced to enter a wolf instead. But you get the idea that maybe if someone was a more powerful warg that he could do that. And, and you know, the close relationship that John has with ghosts, there's a lot of popular speculation that John's going to pop into ghost consciousness, and that was going to be the way – because Martin always says when you come back to life, you're a lesser version of yourself.
Yeah.
Well, if he combines the resurrection powers of Melisandre with the Stark warging powers, it's like there is the ghost as a refrigerator theory.
Right.
That like it has got to keep John's soul fresh, winter fresh. And then when he when the body's brought back, he can fully come back. And I feel like the show has done that, too, because you never heard John. Maybe he said it once or twice. But there's no evidence that John's any less John than he was at the beginning.
Right.
Certainly not in the same way that Beric's always going on and on about. Yeah.
And he's missing an eye. Like,
yeah.
There's a lot of things Beric's got.
John's got
the
giant hole in his heart, but, you know,
yeah,
he's still
pretty.
Yeah,
does that really slow you down?
He's still pretty.
I mean, losing an eye, that affects your depth perception, like physical attributes like that.
So, again, I mean, I take it as a matter of faith, and that word is chosen deliberately, that they're not going to do something like that, where Jon Snow's dead in the books after Dance with Dragons and is not around the next two books, and
that would shock me.
They've invented a romance and all this other stuff. Like I just don't buy it, especially since I don't think young Griff is going to get anywhere near sniffing Danny in that same way. Because the other thing is, people saying that's like, why else have Quaithe and all these? If Danny is going to be ignorant about her own fucking future when so many people have tried with so many methods to warn her about it, then why the hell even have her exposed to that? Like, I fully expect at some point Danny's going to be like, you know what? This shit didn't make sense to me when I first heard it, but I've been around the block a few times. You're the fucking Mummer's Dragon, Dracarys. because again, why have her cued into her own prophecy if, you know, every time she steps into a puddle of dog shit, Quaithe can come in and magic be like, I told you to avoid the dog shit, and here you are with a poopy foot. I mean, that's what a twist. All right, James from New Zealand. From what I can tell, the White Walker armor does stop Dragonglass. In Season 6, Episode 5, The Door, during the assault on Bran's creepy hobbit hole by the Night King and company, one of the children stabs a White Walker in the chest with a dragonglass spear. The spear doesn't penetrate the armor, and the White Walker swats the spear away, then cuts her down. Mira then grabs another spear and throws it, which looks to hit the White Walker in the neck. Boom, frosty sprinkles, and a White Walker blows up.
Huh, okay.
The thing that doesn't really make sense is the armor disintegrates in the same way the Walker does, which would make you think they're one and the same. But in the scheme of things, that doesn't make sense in the show. I consider it a minor nitpick. I agree.
Yeah.
I agree. Like, that's a thing. Like, you know, when the Invisible Man, well, no, that doesn't make sense.
No, his clothes still show up. Yeah.
But like Sue Storm, Fantastic Four, she goes invisible and it's not her
suit.
She doesn't take her spandex off. Now, shit, I'm pretty sure
could be some like developed technology.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Master Fantastic's made her invisible clothes or something. Yeah. Well, shit, you got me there. But still, you know, is Superman's clothes like? Yeah, they got a reason. These comic book nerds are smart. They got a reason for all their bullshit stuff. Like you know, it all tracks out if you read their Wikipedia article. Amy Inn. Two casts ago, you were discussing if Sansa married Tyrion, and would Tyrion be okay with their potential son being a Stark instead of a Lannister? As it happens, I just finished reading a section of Book 2 when Ygritte was taken as Jon's prisoner. Jon asked her to tell him a story, and she tells him it, what she claimed as true history, of a time when hundreds of years ago there had been another king beyond the Wall, and the current Stark of Winterfell challenged this king's bravery.
She goes on to tell how this king tricked a Stark by posing as a singer and stealing his only child, his daughter. The story ends with the Stark old and dying and his daughter returning with a son suckling at her breast. He was now the new Stark in Winterfell, even though the daughter was a Stark and not the father. So this is Bale the Bard story that also has a fulfillment. Oh, man, there's so much difference in the books and the show. Because the books, Mance doesn't die. In fact, right. He leads a commando raid to Winterfell that the Boltons that they're now living in and ostensibly try to rescue Arya, which isn't even Arya. It's all fucking bizarre. So she continues, if this is true, it could be a precedent of sorts when a daughter is the last living descendant and they continue the line through the mother instead of the father. Or I could just be wishing it be true because I've always wished Sansa could have seen how amazing Tyrion was and fall in love with him. Well, I'm not going to ever contradict a shipper.
Yeah.
And honestly, I agree with you, except for the modern Aeron is in there like, yo, Sansa was 13 when she was married to Tyrion, and Tyrion's clearly sexually attracted to her, and it's just kind of creepy and weird, and can you ever see past all that to have them be happy in the books and or show? And I don't know if I can. I don't know if I can.
Okay.
But
I can.
You can?
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go.
I don't know if it's a consequence of not having read.
Super cool.
Don't know if it's
child brides.
Because I haven't read. Well, she's not a child anymore.
Right.
According to the show. I don't know.
She's actually aged in the show, or in the books, they're all still very young.
Yeah.
Very young.
So that's the thing. I don't think it was nearly as creepy in the show as it probably was portrayed in the books. Because he didn't really seem to have that sexual attraction to her in the show.
That's true.
He was when they were married. Stoic. Yeah. He was more like, yeah, we're not going to do this.
Yeah. Yeah, because in the books, my memories are that he, like, kind of was going to go through with the bedding ceremony, and he's, like, on the bed, and but he sees how, like, kind of terrified she is of him and says, this isn't who I am. I'm not going to force myself on this. Plus, he had the whole, you know, as in the show, he had the whole issue with, like, Shay being wroth with him.
Right.
For lusting after the girl. But, yeah, no, I mean, like I said, like, and the other thing is, everybody's got to continue beating through their heads that all this lineage and name shit is just to preserve the peace.
Yeah.
Like it gives society a framework and a continuity so shit doesn't descend into civil war every single time a king dies or a lord dies, which is what would happen without this completely artificial social structure of these families having the rights to rule over ancestral lands.
Mm-hmm.
So in a situation of Game of Thrones where the table has been flipped and everything's in shambles, none of that shit matters. None of that shit matters. They will find a way to tell a story to make itself work. I can already see the Northern's like, well, it's Bale the Bard, essentially. Bale the Bard part two. And everyone's cool with it because else,
yeah.
What are you going to do? Bleed the realm again? No. Moving on to Darrow. Unless it seemed like you had another thought. Okay.
Nope.
Darrow S. I've noticed in several scenes over the seasons that individuals in the Southern Kingdoms who are heads of their respective houses wear sashes like the draped piece of fabric over one shoulder. You can notice this on Randall Tarly in Season 7, Tywin in Season 2 when he arrives at the Battle of Blackwater. Even Daenerys appears to wear something similar in certain formal settings. Is this meant to serve as a designation they're heads of their houses? Is
Jesus.
This a Southern custom or just a coincidence?
You want to talk about falling down rabbit holes of bullshit that's just completely arbitrary and made up. Formal attire. Should we talk about table manners? Should we talk about, like, which dish is supposed to be eaten with which utensil? Because those formalities are complex and just, like, completely ridiculous in my mind.
In an unfortunate case of Game of Thrones, like, Martin, anytime he describes dress and garb, it's the most flamboyant, Renfest kind of shit that you can imagine.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Imagine Henry VIII.
Oh, Jesus.
Like, the big puffy sleeves and
the
giant frills and the weird-ass dresses and the extreme hair. Like, he's always doing shit, like having a dude show up with a gold ring through his nose and purple hair and a forked beard and platinum teeth. And, like, it's always weird, weird shit. Like,
yeah.
Look at some of the foreign editions of Game of Thrones, the covers, and see like how some of these depictions are and what they're wearing. It's like crazy, crazy, fakey looking costume shit.
Yeah.
And Game of Thrones has gone with more of a modern realistic, rugged armor kind of take for this stuff.
Yeah. But there's still that layer of, like, this is what you're supposed to wear when you're in this setting and you're of this stature.
Right.
Like, all of that stuff is totally lost on me. I could not give one crap about it.
Yeah. So now they could be, like I said, they could be trying to do that with the show, like just showing that these sashes are some kind of badge of office.
Sure, yeah.
That's kind of visual language they're establishing, but there's no basis on it in any kind of history or any kind of book stuff that I can determine. Costa M, I have a question about White Harbor. Is it safe to say that North has a Navy and it resides there? Could the Navy still reside there and be available to John now for future needs? What are your thoughts? Are there any reference to this in the show or books that I may have missed? So, in the second book, which I believe is Clash of Kings, it might be Storm. I get those confused all the time. Lord Manderly comes up to Rob and he says, I think now that you're king of the North, we should mint your own coin and use that and let me pay or let me build this massive fleet for you.
Okay.
And then I will, if you give me the money I need, within a year's time, I will make a fleet that can dash both the Lannister and the Baratheon fleet and we can take King's Landing. And Rob's kind of like, yeah, sure, why not? And when I first read that, I remember thinking, here's this rich northern lord trying to take advantage of the young king and be in charge of minting the money and building like this boondoggle fleet, and he's going to be bleeding. It's like, I thought that was part of the intrigue. But then, you know, a lot of things happen. Red Wedding happens, like all the stuff. And then in book five, you know, there's a scene between Davos and Manderly where Davos comes to White Harbor to kind of like, you know, Stannis's move to try to consolidate the northern lords to his side. And Davos sees this like impressive fleet of warships, and Manderly reveals that ever since the death of Rob and Ned, that he's been building up his strength, and he's got all these mounted horse, and like the fucking North will remember, we're gonna fuck these guys, but good. And it's like, yes, yes, like I've been waiting for three books, and finally someone's doing something about these fuckers. However, none of that shit's in the books, or I mean, none of that shit's in the show. So, I thought
the fleet they had was Dany's.
Like, yeah.
That was my impression.
Or, like, Stannis' original one that he bought from...
Okay.
Braavos. And the thing is, like, the Double D's have long since stopped caring about any of that shit. So if Jon and Dany need a fleet, by God, they'll have a fleet.
Yeah.
If they need a fucking earth-moving bridge contraption, like, from Westworld, they'll fucking have one. Like...
Right.
I mean... Yeah, they don't need it. They can if you know, fucking Euron needs 1,000 ships in like 6 weeks. He'll get 1,000 ships in 6 weeks. And none of this stuff matters anymore.
True.
And I'm not like I think going forward, I'm gonna have a very hard and fast rule of like I'm not nitpicking this stuff anymore because
yeah, it's kind of a shame.
You can do it in every single episode. Yeah, certainly
because those are kind of the things that I loved about Game of Thrones was the attention to detail, and. You know, when you lose track of it as a viewer, you have faith that the show has not lost track of it and that they will reintroduce it at some point if it's important.
No, yo, it's really poisonous to a suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's, you know, there's a small segment of the fandom that really cares about the geographic integrity and the travel distance and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the results are in. 100 million people love that shit. They like the dragons. They like the spectacle. And they will trade 5-10 minutes of per season of expository dialogue that would smooth those over in favor of more ice dragons.
Yeah,
so,
I guess so.
that's just the way it is. Christy. As I'm rewatching and listening along with you guys, I've struck with a thought. Do you feel like the Starks ever got revenge for Ned's death? Most of the major players in his death are deceased now, true, but do you feel satisfied like he's been truly avenged? I personally feel like Littlefinger's death was incredibly satisfying, but by the time he'd met his end, he'd done so much horrible stuff. His role in Ned's death felt like just another bullet point on his list, oh crap. We've gotten satisfaction for other Stark injustices, the Red Wedding, Theon's betrayal, Rickon's death. But do you think this is something that the general season 8 audience would still like to see happen? Is revenge for his death still relevant to the plot, or has it already been satisfied and I just missed it?
Yeah, not really for Ned so much. It's tough too because I don't feel as strong of a connection to him as some other characters, you know, especially since, you know, his any kind of like revenge or vengeance they would have got for Ned has been so long delayed after his death.
Right.
That it's hard to really feel that anger about Ned's death that happened in season one, you know? When you're in season five and people are looking to get their throats slit or whatever for it, it's like, do I really care about that anymore? I'm much more interested in, like, Arya slitting Walder Frey's throat or, right. like, for as vengeance for Rob and, like, those kinds of things. So I don't feel like, as a viewer, I'm as concerned with getting vengeance for Ned anymore.
And there's not... Who would you get vengeance on now?
Yeah, at this point, so many of them have died. Because
even Cersei wasn't responsible for Ned's death.
Right.
She, I mean, it's essentially Joffrey. Mm-hmm. Joffrey and Littlefinger were the ones that are most responsible for that, and they're both dead. So mm-hmm. I think, you know, the way I try to live my life is the best revenge is a life well lived. So I think that Ned... Like, our hope for vengeance for Ned will see his children, the ones that survive anyway, prosper and return and help rebuild the realm in the way that would make him proud. And I feel like that thread's going to be intact, because out of Bran, Arya, Sansa, and Jon, I would be willing to make extravagant types of bets that at least one of them will live. And they keep coming back to missing their father and remembering the lessons that he... I feel like that
sure.
one of the bittersweet endings will be those children that are left remaining continuing his legacy of honor and duty to his people. And that will be the sweet revenge that we as the audience get, that the people that were selfish and venal and... greedy and are disposed of, and we have like the Ned in the end, in the long run, his philosophy and his way of life ends up being on top.
Yeah, I think there are certainly other people who have gotten their just desserts more than the people who killed Ned, like a Ramsay Bolton or you know, Walder Frey,
Joffrey.
Sure.
I mean, Joffrey strangling to death is a little bit of vengeance. Now, it wasn't
Like Stannis, like with Brienne.
Right.
Getting to put the final sword through him.
Yeah, that was a good one. That was like the best. That was one of the best. Between that and Arya killing Walder Frey.
And Sansa with Ramsay.
And Meryn Trant, honestly. Like, those are some really good. Those are some really good vengeance scenes.
But none of them were about Ned, right?
None of them were about Ned directly. But I think he would still it'd bring a smile on his face from the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. I don't
know
how
now his statue, he'd be if you go underground.
Arya stabbing dude's eyes out and whatnot. He might wince at that a bit.
Yeah, maybe.
Can't argue the results, though. Brett G. Hey, guys. I'm reading through the books now, halfway through Storm of Swords, and going through the season one episodes of the podcast after a coworker turned me on during season 7. Well, welcome. This may have been covered somewhere, maybe in a season 2 rewatch, which I'm not up to yet, but I had thought about the Miller's wife and the two boys Theon burned pass off as Bran and Rickon. Theon is around 20, 21 at this point, if I remember right, and he had laid with the Miller's wife in the past. Any chances that one of the boys, specifically the younger one, might have been Theon's bastard son? Boy, it's a relevant question because in... So, you blink and you missed it, but in this show, Bran agrees to send two orphan children to the Miller... Well, I think he's a shepherd in this to help watch his flocks.
Are these the two boys that are going to get burned?
These are the two boys that end up getting murdered when Theon, out of frustration, can't find Bran and his brother Rickon.
Hmm.
But you're right. In the books, these are the Miller's natural-born sons, and there's a strong implication that one of these is possibly Theon's children.
Hmm.
It's never said. It's just an implication, which then implies that he is a kinslayer as a list of crimes. He's already got a list of crimes a mile long at this point, but he's also a kinslayer on top of it.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is like, it's an interesting thought, but it doesn't really change the story at all.
No, it doesn't seem like they're going anywhere with
and
that.
And there is no conclusive, like, there's no Maury Povich-style DNA test. It's just their ages line up, and if it gives you an extra, like, oh, Christ, to think about it, and you find that pleasant, then by all means.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's even provable at this point. James F., this might be one of the questions can't be answered, but just like if Theon's fathered and murdered a bastard child. But do you think Dany's story would be stronger if she'd been introduced into the story a bit later?
She does a lot of wheel spinning, mainly, I think, because we have to wait for the dragons to grow up. But more and more, I've been wondering if her character would have been better serviced if she had come in downstream.
I don't know, man. She has so much to learn. I mean, that's the thing that being a book watcher, being a show watcher only.
You just watch them on the shelf. I'm not going to pick them up. Yeah. They look nice over there.
They do. They look at peace. I don't want to disturb
them. They do a good job
them.
Holding the shelves down. They'd just fly off if they weren't there.
That's the thing. I never felt like Dani was just spinning her wheels for the sake of spinning wheels. I feel like she was learning
lessons. Not even a little bit. I mean, I mean,
maybe from time to time, like here and there. But like overall, it's very clear she has a ton of stuff to learn before she's even close to fit to go over to Westeros.
Yeah.
And she has so many people that she has to meet and learn lessons from. I just think that takes time. And if you're going to portray it in any kind of realistic fashion, You need to do it over years.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. That's something, because this is where, like, I kind of wonder if I've contaminated you a bit, because after reading Dance of Dragons and being like, what the fuck? Seriously, Dany has been stuck in here, and there's this fucking mare, and now she's riding off with Drogon, and like, okay, fine, like, okay, at the end of this book, I can kind of squint and see her getting to Westeros. I was really frustrated. And then I read some online stuff about, like, they kind of delved into all the different things that she goes through in those two books and, like, the path that she goes on. And you know, as emotionally satisfying as it would have been for her to fight out a Karth with a ship and a good captain and three smallish dragons. And,
right, her dragons aren't ready. Like,
I mean, as satisfying as it would be to see her bring fire and blood and live up to someone's promises, like, it would have been super unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be young adult fiction. She'd be Katniss Everdeen.
And I think it would also equally be bad if you were to try to imply that all this stuff was happening behind the scenes and that she was a young girl learning lessons, but we never saw any of that.
Right.
And then we join up with her when she's got the dragons and she's got the ships and she's ready to breathe the fire.
Yeah.
Because we don't follow her on that journey, you know?
Yeah.
I think you need to.
I wonder if you couldn't compress it a little bit. The one thing is, like, maybe. I think you need to introduce her early, because I did think it was interesting, the machinations as far as, you know, Robert Baratheon trying to kill her and that meaning friction between him and Ned, and also, like, that, you know, that you deepen that appreciation when you realize that Ned is also harboring a fugitive Targaryen, and he's in his mind, that's pretty weighty. And then the betrayal that she uncovers from Jorah, like, all they kind of have to be along for the ride to feel all that. Like, I agree. I think you could take a book's worth of Dany's development and throw it the fuck away and still have almost all of her necessary plot line intact. But I also think, like, I definitely don't agree that if she had flown over at the end of book two and started joining the Game of Thrones, it would have been satisfying at all.
No, those dragons have to be much bigger.
And that's more of, like, it's not just her. Like, I do think that Martin probably could easily get a half a book's worth of stuff out of Feast and Dance, and we'd all be the better for it. But that's my opinion. It's not a widely held or respected one. It's just mine. Amy T. In the Dragon Pit, when Jon is demonstrating how fire and dragon glass are the only things that kill the wights and others, why did he forget to mention the Valyrian steel? I get that there aren't many Valyrian blades, but three of them were there in the Dragon Pit. Longclaw, Oathkeeper, and Widow's Wail. It's a huge oversight on Jon's part to not point out one of the very few ways to stop this existential threat.
Maybe he didn't want to reveal the secret.
Well, that's what do you think?
He knows they got Valyrian steel. That's a fine point. I don't know why.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, if there's so few, if there's less than 100 in the entire world at this point.
Valyrian steel swords?
Yeah. Is it a big omission?
Yeah, if you can't get them in bulk, what's the point even?
You have no way to produce more, whereas there is a readily mined source. Like, I don't know. I think, for sure, if I was Jon, I would throw that in just for completeness sake.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that it's the fatal oversight that you're wanting it to be, Amy. Again, I could be wrong, but it's kind of like, oh, the only way you can stop the aliens with a nuclear bomb, and it's 1945 and we only had two and we just dropped them on Japan.
Right.
Like, okay, like if you can stop aliens with nuclear weapons or coal. Like, it'd be I'd be okay with the presidential briefing leaving out the nuke part, and that's knowing full well that that the United States had the capability to make more nukes. Eventually, you know, like if like they shot the two and that's all there is, like, let's stick with the coal. Let's just lob hunks of coal at the aliens. Cassie W, final email of the day. I finally discovered the YouTube videos of the DVD extras produced by HBO on the Game of Thrones lore, which is the best part of the DVDs and Blu-rays, by the way. They have these really lovingly illustrated charcoal pencil art as characters from the show narrate the histories and backstories of all these houses, and it's pretty good. When watching one for season 2, I noted the one about the Curse of Harrenhal. It's narrated by Catelyn Stark, and she says something to the effect of, "Everyone who rules Harrenhal thinks they will escape the curse, but their lines have all been ended. I knew about the Curse of Death, but the entire line ending was a new one to me." As far as I can remember, the show has been ruled by Tywin Lannister, Roose Bolton, Robb Stark, and Littlefinger. Robb's line ended when he is killed along with his unborn child at the Red Wedding. Roose's line ended when he is killed along with Ramsay and his newborn baby boy. And now Littlefinger's line has been ended, which leaves Tywin. I think we all expect that Jaime and Cersei will die before producing more offspring, but what does this curse mean for Tyrion? I can't remember if Tywin holds Harrenhal in the books, but either way, this was content created for the show. Well, he doesn't hold Harrenhal. I don't. Maybe he does chase Roose out at the end, but does he hold it? And okay, so she wants to know if this isn't a sign of impending doom for Tyrion. And my thought is, no, it's entirely too fuzzy, the concept of who holds it and all that. Like, there's a bunch of debates, and it's all very Nostradamus-y. And also, I don't know that the double, like, and if they do, if it turns out that, like, Jaime and Tyrion both die, I'm pretty sure it won't be because the double D's want to pay off this prophecy thing. It's more, that's just what makes sense character. What do you think, man?
That's a tough one. I don't really know the definition of hold. Like, is that what Tywin is doing right now in the show? Holding Harrenhal?
Well, it's promised to Littlefinger right now. So, okay.
Does that mean sitting down in a chair in Harrenhal?
Yeah, if you're squatting,
we're
going
to rest tonight.
Let's say a bandit while Harrenhal was abandoned. Let's say that he just spends the night there. Does he die? Did he hold Winterfell? Like, Tywin is essentially squatting there and using it as a garrison, but it belongs to Littlefinger technically.
Yeah.
So who?
Though he doesn't want it.
Who actually holds it? I don't know. And I also think that at this point it has very little predictive power, because there's lots of good reasons. There's lots of good plot and character based reasons for Tyrion and Jaime to die, and for the entire Lannister, honestly, for the entire Lannister line to be wiped out. I don't want to see Jaime and Tyrion die, but.
No, I would rather not have them die. But I don't know. I put very little faith, I guess, in those kind of stories and myths from the show. But I guess I'm putting more and more faith in them as I see, like, the stuff that Bran was told coming true. And, like, a lot of the old stories, you know, about the White Walkers themselves, right? They're part of the mythos. But some of these I just don't lend much credence to as far as the story goes.
The other thing is, like, does it count if, like, I one of my fan fictions I wrote is that Cersei has this baby. Maybe it's Euron's baby. Maybe it's Jaime's baby. But it is going to be raised as Jon Snow and Dany's own. Does that continue their line technically? Because they're not going to have the last name and no one will know it's true.
Right.
Is Rhaegar's line still intact?
Right.
Like it's like if the heir never finds out his true last name, if the tree falls in the forest and no one's here there to hear it, does it make a sound? A lot of these things are philosophical, honestly. And I'm more interested, as I said, in the prophecies predictive abilities. And I feel like there's a lot more prophecies with predictive powers as it applies to Jaime and Tyrion than this throwaway line about Harrenhal.
Sure.
Which is also, none of that shit's super non-canonical. It's not like this is an actor reading narration by the HBO's marketing team that I'm sure was, like, you know, ran by Martin or the Double D's at some point, but it's not the books or the show.
Yeah.
It's a fucking bonus feature on a DVD.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say it's wrong, you know what I'm saying? So
sure.
That's way too much probably to spend on that issue, but that's how I feel about it. That's it. GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. If you'd like to send us feedback, there's also always discussions going on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. And you can follow us along at all the social medias. Just put in, there's a prize search box on the social media. You can put in Bald Move and boom, we're right there.
Yeah. I think as of 2017, all of the social medias have search boxes.
I think so.
Yeah.
They finally pioneered the search box.
They did. Technology. So, yeah, just search Bald Move on there. but that's it. We're going to be back next week for episode 6. We're halfway through the season.
Yeah, we're on the downhill part.
Yep. Should be a fun ride. We will see you guys next week.
See ya.